We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're Dads on the Air. We're back with Dads on the Air.
Good morning and welcome to Dads on the Air for the 22nd of June 2010. I am Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com, author of The Daddy's Split Guide, which is available from lulu.com, and I'm joined in the studio by Phil York from Dads in Distress. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Ian. Good morning, everyone.
You've got a huge show this morning. This week on Dads on the Air, we will be playing an interview that Greg Andreessen from the 1 in 3 campaign conducted recently with Dr. Greg Deer. Dr. Greg Deer is Senior Lecturer in Psychology in the School of Psychology and Social Science at Edith Cowan University in Western Australia. He is also the co-author, along with Professor Alfred Allen and Emily Tolbrook, of Intimate Partner Abuse of Men, a research project commissioned by the Men's Advisory Network and released on the 26th of May, 2010. So stay tuned for that one. We'll be playing that after the first break. But what do we got in the news? What's happened, Phil? What do we got?
There's a very exciting message here from President Barack Obama, which I'd like to share with everyone. He writes, "As a father of two young daughters, I know that being a father is one of the most important jobs any man can have. My own father left my family when I was 2 years old. I was raised by an heroic mother and wonderful grandparents who provided the support, discipline and love that helped me to get to where I am today. But I still felt the weight of that absence throughout my childhood. It is something that leaves a hole that no government can fill." He goes on to say that he has started the conversation around the importance of being a father, and that studies show that children who grow up without their fathers around are more likely to drop out of high school, go to jail, or become teen fathers themselves. He goes on to write that in a few places, including Chicago, the Department of Health and Human Services held a forum with community leaders, fatherhood experts and everyday dads to discuss the importance and responsible fatherhood support programs. And he's moving on with this, which is great.
It is great.
Great to see. And there's he has auspiced a government website known as www.fatherhood.gov, and you know, it says there quite clearly the smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. So it's interesting stuff from President Obama.
Yeah, well, that's great. The leader of the Western world showing some positive leadership and coming out in favor of the dads, which is always a good thing. I think dads in this day and age have been vilified, and it's good to hear Barack Obama basically just talking sense. It's everything he said there was completely obvious, backed up by studies, science, everything else, and yep. Just sensible.
Absolutely, yeah. And he's talking from that personal level. He's been through it himself, and he knows what it's like. And as he said, no government can fill that gap. So it's important that dads have that opportunity to be part of their children's lives for their children's sake.
Fair enough. Okay, well, I've got an article here from Sunday's Sun Herald. Les Kennedy has written under the heading "Girl 13 Sold for Fuel." In 2004, a woman only known as NJJ sold her 13-year-old daughter to a truck driver for a load of diesel while in a drug-fueled haze. It would be one of three such encounters for the girl with the man known as JRR. Well, this is disgusting.
It is.
You know, where was the father? That's all you got. If the father, I don't know, maybe he was in a drug-fueled haze somewhere else. Who knows? Tragic, awful, disgusting stuff. They're in court. They'll probably go to jail, which, of course, is not going to help. Well, the 13-year-old with a mother like that, she's better off away from the mother, you would think. And the obvious question is, where's the father? Anything else you got over there, Phil?
No, not at the moment, mate. You're all right, mate. It's been very quiet news week.
No, well, I've got another couple here. Well, look, let me give you one. You can do this one. Now, I've got here, she's a ray of hope for IVF bubs. Kelly Lane wrote in the Sun Herald this Sunday again, one of Australia's first IVF babies has given birth to her own naturally conceived daughter, defying fears that IVF children inherit infertility. So that's pretty interesting because there has been, IVF, obviously, in vitro fertilization, lots of large words. They're basically test tube babies. And, now they're coming of age and, you know, because there have been, well, I personally have had a few doubts myself about, you know, the spiritual implications of combining the parts necessary to create a human being in a test tube in a laboratory as opposed to in a loving relationship in bed with mum and dad, which is a completely different scenario. But it seems that, well, if that, you know, if she can conceive and, you know, get married and, yeah, good luck to her. Good news. Fabulous stuff.
And we have one here from today's Daily Telegraph, and the headline reads, "Music Fuels Love. It might just be time to dust off the Barry White album. Romantic music is the key to getting a woman's phone number, scientists have found." According to a French study, she is twice as likely to agree.
A French study?
A French study.
People that French.
Listening to soppy love songs, previously the same team found men spent more money in florists when romantic music was played. So there you go.
So there you go. Well, that just goes to show the power of music more than anything, and I guess... Well, what's that say? It affects men and women in a kind of similar way. But, there you go. Fabulous. Well, that's why we play all this music all the time. Well, okay, I guess I'll play some. See how if this makes people want to run off and buy flowers and ask women for their phone numbers.
I'm sure it's going to be very romantic.
Well, it's not actually. This is Horizon Shine. This is Psycho Schizo Babe.
I'm Welcome back to Dad's on the Air.
I'm speaking with Dr. Greg Deer, and Greg is the Senior Lecturer in Psychology in the School of Psychology and Social Science at Edith Cowan University in Western Australia. Greg is the co-author, along with Professor Alfred Allen and Emily Tilbrook, of Intimate Partner Abuse of Men, which is a research project commissioned by the Men's Advisory Network and released on the 26th of May 2010. Greg, thank you for talking with us today.
No problem.
First of all, can you tell our listeners about the aims and objectives of the research?
Well, look, I suppose in broad terms, the aim was to collect men who report being victims of intimate partner violence, to collect rich data about the nature of their experiences. In other words, what sort of violence they experience from an intimate partner or have experienced, how it has impacted on them, and more specifically, what sorts of factors have influenced their decision to disclose that abuse or to not disclose that abuse to other people. We were particularly interested in understanding the difficulties that men have in disclosing abuse to service providers in a range of categories.
Okay, so it was very much a qualitative project.
That was certainly the first part of it, and I think the important part of it. The second stage was a survey of service providers where we sought to quantify, I suppose, in some ways, their views on the data that we had collected in the first phase of the study. In particular, the degree to which they recognised in men who they've worked with the types of barriers to disclosure that we identified in the first phase of the research.
Well, let's talk a bit about stage one of your research, the qualitative interviews with the male victims, but also with significant for other people in their lives and some individual service providers, I believe, who had helped male victims. What different forms of abuse did you unearth in stage one when you talked to these people?
One of the questions that we asked in the interviews was a broad, open-ended question about when they say they've been victims of abuse, what do they mean by that? How do they define abuse? What are the sorts of experiences they've had? And then we thematically analysed the conversation that followed from that opening question. I make that point because we were quite deliberate in not wanting to give a sort of checklist of the definitions that exist in the literature or the way that intimate partner violence is categorised into emotional abuse or social abuse or physical abuse, etc. We really wanted to just get a free-flowing conversation of what do the men and family and friends, significant others of men who report abuse, what do they mean by that? What is it that they have experienced? What are the behaviours that have been done to them? And what's their understanding of, more broadly, what abuse might entail, so beyond just what they've experienced? And when we analysed those data, they fell very nicely into the same sorts of categories and definitions as exist in the literature already. So all of the social abuse, financial abuse, pretty much the same ways that these are defined in the literature. An additional category that emerged, and when I say additional, there is some limited research on this and discussion in the literature, but it's not universally recognised in the taxonomies that people use in the literature,
mm-hmm.
And that was the category of what we called legal or administrative abuse. We sort of struggled on how to label that, and that was the use of legal and administrative processes to control, intimidate and abuse the man.
And what sort of, can you give some examples of the sort of things?
Actually, probably a good thing to do to answer that question is to go to some of the, let me see if I can find some of the quotes that will illustrate that.
I think I've got one here. This is reading from the report. You know, I haven't said hello to the lady, yet alone been anywhere near her for more than 8 years. Why am I being served with the VRO? You have to, like, sacrifice so much effort to prove yourself innocent. It is ridiculous, and a lot of men just aren't. They can't cope with it.
Yep, I mean, that's a classic one. Another one is, there's quite a lot of references by some of the men to the use of various proceedings in family court. And there's some interesting ones as well about with immigrant men, and a couple of the service providers mentioned this, where the wives will threaten to withdraw the sponsorship.
Mm.
So if you're a sort of non-Australian resident who has come here with a partner, either married or de facto, who is an Australian citizen, then you come here as a sponsored immigrant, and the sort of threats to remove the sponsorship so that he'll be deported.
Mm.
So there's a range of... I mean, another example that comes to mind that isn't quoted in the report was the anecdote by one of the male victims we interviewed, who told about an occasion when he actually called the police because she was basically throwing things around the kitchen. Mm. And she wasn't directly, like, physically assaulting him, but he sensed that what was coming next was that she would start throwing objects at him.
Mm.
And the children were there witnessing this. So he phoned the police, who duly arrived and took her and the children to protect the children from him.
Mm.
Because when the police arrived, she gave a different version of events to him. And the police, their automatic assumption was that the children were at risk from him rather than at risk from her. So she and the children were, well, he doesn't know where they were taken, but we can assume a refuge.
Mm.
So, I mean, these are examples, if you like, at least this is what the men tell us.
Mm.
These are examples of how a female partner uses legal and administrative systems that are in place to protect people who are at risk of violence and deliberately misuse them in order to gain power in the relationship effectively.
And we'll be back with more of Dr. Greg Deer in a moment.
The single man with a ring around the bath and a cigarette butt in my beer, and I haven't always been a lonely man, and I haven't always lived alone. You know I haven't always drunk this much, but hey, before you cut me down, just try standing in my shoes, 'cause I don't have to hear one word out of this mouth. Any other day, I care what you say, but every Saturday is Father's Day. You might call it sad, you might call me mad, but I've got one who calls me dad. Folks that live up here know how to leave a man alone. Not a bad old bunch that live up here. I bet you know that it's not family and it's not home. While of a darling wife but once I had, well, I'm pleased to say that she still talks to me. Try not to think of what went wrong, 'cause if I said that I was right, she might say that she was right, and the only rights I care about are visiting her eyes. Yeah. Any other day, I care what you say, but every Saturday is Father's Day. You might call it sad, you might call me mad, but I've got calls me dad. We go where he wants to go, we do what he wants to do. I tell him everything I know, 'cause I'd do anything to prove, yeah, I'd do anything to prove, that every Saturday
do just what he says, cause each and every Saturday is Father's Day. You might call it sad, you might call me mad, but it don't feel so bad when he calls me. You might call it sad, you might call me mad, but it don't feel half bad when he calls me. You might call it sad, when he calls me dad. Yeah, he calls me dad. I haven't always been a single man.
You're back with Dad's on the Air. We're speaking with Dr. Greg Deere, Senior Lecturer in Psychology at Edith Cowan University in Western Australia. I'm just going back to an earlier point that you made about letting the men tell their own stories in their own words, you know, rather than putting a checklist there or even asking them, you know, have you been a victim of domestic violence or have you been a victim of intimate partner abuse?
That opening question was asked of them because really what we were quite deliberate in seeking people, you know, advertising for people to contact us and participate in the research to tell us about their experiences of being abused by a female partner or by an intimate partner.
Okay, so the specific question was asked, but then in terms of the sorts of experiences they had, they were then free to elaborate.
Yeah, so any man who contacted us and said, you know, I've heard the a radio interview that you did, or I saw the flyer and the wherever, or I saw the ad in the community newspaper, and I've been a victim of abuse from a partner, well then we would take that on face value. And the opening part of the interview was really asking him to explain what he means by that. What is the abuse that has been done to him?
I guess the question I'm getting at is whether, do you think you might have actually missed some men in recruiting research subjects by specifying domestic abuse, in the sense that, do you think that some men may not identify their relationship experiences as domestic violence or abuse the way that possibly women may have been more educated to identify those experiences? So, for example, if their partner is, you know, not giving them access to the funds in the house or whatever, that women may be more likely to sort of think of that as domestic violence or abuse, and men may not, and therefore may not have called up to take part in your study. Do you think that's an issue?
I think that's a huge issue. I was about to say I have no doubt, but I don't know if I can substantiate that assertion. Let me put it this way. I'm confident that many men who would have been good participants in our research would not recognise that they are victims of abuse and so, you know, would not have responded. It was, in fact, a thing that came through our data from significant others who we interviewed, and, I mean, that was something that we expected, and it was part of our rationale for including significant others in the study, a deliberate part of the design, because we thought it might be the case that very few men would put their hands up if they do recognise themselves, that other men would fail to recognise what they are experiencing as intimate partner abuse or domestic violence, but that other members of the family who are aware of it might recognise it as that. It's interesting that all but one of the significant others who contacted us were women who might be like the current partner of a man who was abused by a previous partner, the man's sister, who is aware of what is going on or has been going on in the relationship, and in one case, the one male significant other was talking about the relationship between his parents and his mother's psychological and physical abuse of his father. And a strong theme coming through the significant others was that the men don't recognise that what's happening to them is domestic violence. They recognise it as abusive and wrong, and, you know, they would like it to stop, but the label of domestic violence is something that they either refuse to put on their experience or just fail to conceptualise it in that way. And then in the service providers echoed that theme to some extent as well. And indeed, one of the barriers to disclosing is men's failure to recognise it as domestic violence, or their reluctance or refusal to see it in those terms for a whole variety of reasons.
Do you think that one of the causes for this may be, I guess, an unintended consequence of community education campaigns that we've had over many years, which have done a great deal in terms of raising the awareness of the issue of domestic violence for women? Do you think one of the unintended consequences of that might be that some men may think that, you know, domestic violence is something that happens to women, and therefore, you know, what I'm experiencing can't be domestic violence?
It's entirely possible that that's part of it.
Would you hazard a guess as to what other things may be behind that? Is it something about men's sense of masculinity, or...?
That was a strong theme coming through our data, and in particular, I think that... And I'm going beyond our data here and sort of hypothesising, but... I think is behind the sort of reluctance to label it as domestic violence, and sometimes the what significant others described as, you know, he just outright denies it, even though, you know, in one sense he knows it's happening and talks about it, but you know, denies that it's domestic violence. I think part of it is around issues of masculinity. And that was a strong theme in our data that related to the shame that men experience, the difficulty they have in admitting it to themselves, first of all, and secondly, disclosing it to service providers, that, you know, men are tough and men can cope, and a, you know, a bit of push and shove and all the rest of it, you know.
They're supposed to be able to take care of themselves.
Yep, we take care of ourselves and we're tough and all the rest of it. But beyond those sort of, I suppose, stereotypical masculine constructs, it was a sense that people out there aren't going to understand or believe what I'm going through because it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit the mould. It doesn't fit the definition of what is meant by domestic violence. So I think that's where the issue that you raised might come into it.
And did some men actually have experience of this? For example, going to the police station and not being taken seriously? Or?
Yep, absolutely. There's a couple of examples of that we quote from in the report. In fact, one man who reports that he went to apply for domestic... it was a significant other who reported this in the interview. She accompanied... I can't remember who it was, her brother or something. Anyway, she accompanied the man in to court when he was applying for violence restraining order against his ex-wife, I think it was. And, well, according to what the significant other told us, the magistrate said, look, you know, this guy's apparently quite tall and not slight, and the magistrate just said to him, you're a big, strong lad, you should be able to take care of yourself, and declined the order. Now, I find that quite astounding, because what I've seen in court a lot of times is magistrates, on occasion, sort of voicing that they're not 100% convinced that this is necessary, but a person has a right to demand that someone else leave them alone, so they'll issue it. I've heard that a number of times.
Well, it's all the more shocking that, to me, almost the inference of his tone was that, you know, the guy could sort of defend himself, which would almost imply hitting her back, which is, you know, in a sense almost justifying
further. Well, I mean, yeah, one can only guess what the magistrate might have meant
what he might
by
have meant.
That, and whether or not that is an accurate quote of what the magistrate said, it's clearly the message that this woman took away from accompanying, I think it was her brother, into court. And then her remark was, so he walked out of court just feeling even more stupid than he did when he walked in, and thinking, well, if, you know, if I can't get support here, who else is going to believe me? And there are a number of occasions where men reported, you know, similar things from the police. It was interesting that in the second part of the study, quite a number of the service providers recognised this as being an issue that is not just within the men's perception, that they think they won't be believed or won't be supported or won't be taken seriously, but the service providers themselves were telling us that that's actually what sometimes happens, and that they have seen that happen. There were even a couple of service providers who made comments in our survey, it was largely quantitative, but there were some sections where they could write comments, and we took those comments and analysed qualitative analysis of that text. And there were a small number of service providers who basically expressed views like, look, if the man is reporting being a victim of abuse, then her behaviour towards him is probably retaliation for something he started himself. So, I mean, if people are, service providers are participating in a survey about men's experience as victims of intimate partner abuse, and that's the comment that they're making, then I think that itself further illustrates what other parts of our data are saying, that the men worry or are concerned that they won't be believed or supported, or indeed that they might even be blamed, that they don't expect members of the community to understand that this happens to men. A lot of them are ashamed that it has happened to them, feeling less of a man, like a failure, that this is something I should have been able to prevent or sort out. And then, as we've already discussed, some of them report the experience of not just worrying that that sort of response might occur, but they've experienced it. And the service providers are telling us that they've seen it occur, and then a couple of the service providers are actually demonstrating that in the way they've responded to the survey. So I think all of that adds up to a fairly consistent picture that I think there are problems in the way that the health, welfare, justice field responds to men who disclose being victims, and I think it's a very different response than those same people would give to a female victim.
Well, certainly in 2010 it may be a similar response to, I'm hypothesising here, but it may be a similar response to that women may have got, you know, in 1950. but thankfully, at least we have service providers now that you would hope would be more sensitive to women that approached them in 2010.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've worked in terms of my clinical work in the alcohol field and working with families. I've worked with many women in the 1980s and 1990s who were still getting that sort of response from police. It was the minority rather than, you know, the standard response, and there were quite a few deliberate campaigns and training and other things that the police did across the 1990s that really improved things. So, you know, we probably don't have to go all the way back to the 1950s to find that women were experiencing the same thing that men are now reporting.
And we'll be back after this track.
I went to the hospital with my pregnant wife. She So fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress. 1-300-853-437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air. Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. We're listening to an interview with Dr. Greg Deer from Edith Cowan University in Western Australia. And Greg recently, along with his colleagues Alfred Allen and Emily Tilbrook, conducted a survey on intimate partner abuse of men. And this interview's been given to us with the kind permission of the One in Three campaign. You can listen to it again at their website, oneinthree.com.au. The positives to take out of that may be that if you put the proper training and procedures in place within police and services, etc., that improvements can be made in terms of their education and their sensitivity to the issue. Would you think that that's the case?
Yeah. Well, I think that's very much the case. And I don't want to single out police here either, because, I mean, there were some police officers who participated in the survey, and certainly police representatives on our steering committee and other contacts I've had with police who specialise in this area. So I think there's actually other sections of the service field in health and welfare areas probably have a worse track record in this area than the police do.
Mm.
Yeah, it just happened that some of the examples that came to mind involved police and courts.
Sure. And look, and I'm sure there are many police officers out there who are genuinely sympathetic and do a very good job. So, yeah, I don't think we should infer by one example that it should tar... all the police in that way, but certainly some police officers obviously do need some more training in this area. And
yeah, well, one of our key recommendations was really that across the field there needs to be a lot more training in relation to responding to men who report experiences of intimate partner abuse or family violence more broadly.
Mm.
And I think that some of the gender issues, I think, are extremely important in this, the same way that the sort of gender issues are central to understanding women's experience of domestic violence. I think one of the important things to emerge from our data is that that's also the case for men. And it makes sense, because all aspects of human experience are filtered through gendered identity as one aspect of the self-concept. Who I am, how I see myself, is influenced by my concept of what it means to be a man.
And your biology is as a man as well, in some sense.
Yep. Mm. So the understanding what it means, and obviously it's going to vary from individual to individual, but in general, what it means for a man to put up his hand, a man in our culture to put his hand up and say, this has happened to me and I'm not coping with it and I want some help, needs to be properly understood by the people who respond to that. And men aren't necessarily going to present themselves in the same way as women might. One of the, and we don't really talk about this in the report, but we sort of reflected on it afterwards, but one of the things coming through quite strongly in the interviews is, it was really after some conversation of the topic that men got to a point where they started to speak about their emotions and about the effects of the abuse on them. And the interviewer really had to sort of probe for that, like a general question asking about, what are some of the effects of this? men would initially respond in purely behavioural terms, talking about the event. And it was only by sort of more and more probing that they would eventually get to talking about sense of shame and things like that. When you interview women about their experience of violence, family violence or other forms of violence, they will move very quickly from telling you what happened to telling you how they feel about it, and in richer detail about how it's impacted on them, on their functioning, on how they see themselves. Women, and this is an overgeneralisation, but women move into those topics of conversation more easily than men do. And we know that from a whole range of research topics and research on that issue itself, including how men perform in counselling and a whole range of other settings. So it's not just when researchers talk to them.
Mm. And what are the implications of that for future research?
It's like if men are operating with a sense that I should be tough and I should be able to cope and I don't want to present myself as unable to cope, then they will stay at that surface level of, oh, yeah, well, you know, she did this and that's what happened and, you know, how did that affect you? Oh, well, you know, my hand hurt for a couple of days, but it got better. Or, you know, whatever the case may be. And I think men need a lot more help to actually identify and articulate some of the deeper psychological impacts of that experience. And it is one of the controversies in the field, as you well know, that, like, are men who are abused by women, are they intimidated by that abuse? Are they fearful of the abusive partner in the same way that many women are? And I think men and women articulate anxiety and fear and things like that differently. Now, certainly some of the men in our then first phase of our study were able to articulate being intimidated, a sense of being trapped, of being controlled, overpowered, and the impacts of that in terms of, as a man, I should be better than this. I shouldn't let myself get into this situation. What's wrong with me? So blaming myself for the experience one is having. Now, you know, I'm not suggesting that women don't experience those things. In fact, there's a wealth of research that a lot of women do. But there is some question in the field about, is the impact of a female partner's violence to a male truly one of intimidation and achieving power and control over the partner? Whereas there's no doubt that a lot of women are intimidated and controlled by the violence or the threat of violence, or their perception that there's a threat of violence. Well, our data suggests that at least some men were able to articulate that experience.
And we'll be back with more of the interview after this track.
I'm frightened of the things I might find.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. We're listening to Dr. Greg Deer from Edith Cowan University in Western Australia talking about his study into the intimate partner abuse of men. In terms of future research, especially large-scale epidemiological research, looking at the prevalence or the quantitative aspect of this problem, would you recommend against having a, you know, a tick box for both men and women that said, you know, did you experience fear as a result of your... Or if such a tick box was there, would you expect that at least some men would fail to tick that, even though they may be experiencing some of the same things that women were, because of that language that men and women may use differently in terms of articulating the experiences that they go through as being fearful or anxious or controlled or all that sort of...
Yeah, and we've been talking about this because when we were first... there was a call for tenders about doing this research, and when we first... Alfred and I got together and spoke about, well, if we were to tender for this project, what approach would we take? The original tender was almost asking for research to identify prevalence of violence against men. And we quickly formed the view that we were concerned that if, and there was already some discussion of this in the literature, that if men fail to recognise what they're experiencing as abuse, or if they articulate that or use different words or have a different sense of what abuse means, particularly if they fail to recognise forms of abuse other than physical assault, then we might be thinking we're measuring the same thing as when we ask those questions of women, but we might be failing to pick up a lot of the prevalence. We might be failing to identify cases because we don't know enough about how men conceptualise this. What are the barriers to disclosure? We were interested in that question because it's an important one for service providers, but we were also interested because if there are specific barriers to men disclosing, then those barriers might prevent them from disclosing on a sort of written questionnaire type survey. And so that was why we actually settled for this sort of design, to see if we could understand those issues more thoroughly, not only to guide service providers on, okay, you know, men aren't going to approach you and put their hand up in the same way that women will, but also to understand that as researchers for how do we need to design prevalent studies that are going to be reliable and valid. I've pretty much come to the conclusion that if there's going to be effective prevalent surveys of both men's and women's experience, they will need to be interview-based. Now, I know the ABS one was interview-based, but I'm not sure that it really went into sufficient detail to understand similarities and differences in men's and women's experience and prevalence rates. And I think it's one of those conundrums where, in order to be able to compare two groups, you want to make sure that you're asking the same questions, that you're collecting the same data. So if you find one percentage in one group and a different percentage in the other, you know it's a real difference because you've measured the same thing. But the conundrum is sometimes in order to measure something accurately in one group, like in males rather than females, and this is a common conundrum in cross-cultural and multinational research where they're comparing experiences in one country to another, that the way to measure something accurately in one culture might require a different approach to collecting the data than in the next country. And it seems to me, at least, that the way to extract the information that you need from men needs to be somewhat different than the way you extract the information from women. And part of that might be with the point you raised right at the beginning, that women have had a lot of exposure over the years, and rightly so, that enables them or assists them. There's a lot of women still have problems disclosing abuse by a partner and for a whole range of reasons.
Sure.
But they have had a lot of experiences, and particularly younger women, in the way that these issues are dealt with in school education, in public campaigns, in support services, in the training. It's like the word is out in the whole community that victims need to be believed and supported, and there's no shame in speaking about this having happened to you. Women still feel ashamed, but not to the same degree as they did decades ago to prevent them from disclosing or to significantly delay their disclosing. whereas I think men do feel that sort of shame, and they don't really, certainly one of the themes coming through our data, they don't have the sense that this is an acceptable topic to simply talk about and admit to. Plus, there's a whole range of, you know, we know from a wealth of studies that if you want to get information about people's emotions and to articulate their feelings, men do that differently than women.
Mm.
I'm reminded, actually, of, in a completely different field, some research in the early 80s on with problem drinkers and understanding risk of relapse. And there were some very good studies that seemed to indicate that for men, relapses were precipitated more by situational things. In other words, an example of a situational trigger relapse might be that everyone at work is going out for drinks on a Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And you're in that situation where everyone's drinking and you're the odd one out, and, you know, before too long you end up joining in, etc. So that's a sort of high-risk situation for a problem drinker who's trying to give up drinking. Women's relapses were, more often than men, triggered by mood states and experiences. So for women, it might be when I'm depressed and bored and get those thoughts of self-loathing and, you know, that I've wrecked my life already, so...
Mm, so I might as well have a drink.
I'm feeling like crap, so I might as well have a drink.
Mm.
So there was a lot of emphasis on, well, we need to do quite different things in relapse prevention with men than in women. We need to teach men how to deal with high-risk situations and women how to deal with their feelings and sort of focus. Well, then there was some other research that looked more deeply into those issues and found that men relapsed in those high-risk situations when they were feeling bad.
Mm.
But unless you really persist, you don't get that information. Plus, with women, it wasn't any time I'm feeling bad, but when I'm feeling bad and I'm in the wrong sort of situation.
Mm.
And the end result of probing more deeply into men's and women's experiences was that both men and women tend to relapse, both in terms of situational and internal mood states and other internal, you know, attitudinal, you know, the wrong sort of thinking. And it's a combination of situational and psychological factors that runs a higher risk of relapsing.
Mm, but a superficial examination, that they means they actually come out, they describe their experiences in different ways.
Because men will focus on where they were and what was happening when they did it, and women will focus more on how they were feeling when they did it rather than the situation they were in.
And we'll be back shortly.
Something more.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back. You're listening to Dads on the Air on 89.3 to GLF. We're listening to an interview with Dr. Greg Deer that's been given to us by the 1 in 3 campaign. And Greg is a senior lecturer in psychology at Edith Cowan University in Western Australia. And he's talking to the 1 in 3 campaign about his study looking into the intimate partner abuse of men. Greg, in terms of your research, what are some of your suggestions in terms of things that could be done to help male victims become more willing to report their abuse?
This is a bit of a big picture issue, if you like, but really what the conclusion that we came to and why we made the... We could have made 100 specific recommendations, and some of them would have been probably going beyond our data. So in the end, we settled for 4 broad recommendations.
Do you want to just outline those recommendations?
The first one really gets to the heart of your question. And if I read from the report here, the first recommendation was that government-funded public awareness campaigns be conducted to raise awareness of intimate partner violence against men. Such campaigns need to be very carefully designed so as to complement campaigns about family violence against women and children and not to damage the effectiveness of those campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
Because really the key issue for the men was not only their own sense of shame and difficulty in admitting it to themselves that this is what is happening to them, but their perception, and quite likely an accurate perception, that other people wouldn't understand what they're going through or might not believe it or might not be supportive in their responses.
Or may blame the men themselves.
Or even worse, might even blame them. And I think one of the men actually made a comment along the lines of that one of the first people he disclosed it to said, well, what are you doing to make her do that to you? Now, all of us who work in the field know how wrong it is to say that to a female victim, but why did someone in a health service say that to a male victim? Another one of our recommendations is about training for people working in health and welfare and justice fields, but it really needs to start with a community awareness campaign that puts this conversation about this does happen to men, to some men, how do we understand it, what do we do about it, and to really put it out there as a topic of discussion in the general community the same way that violence against women and children is, because that frees up men to be able to talk about it themselves. It's not going to suddenly magically, you know, make men stand up in any public venue and say, hey, you know, by the way, did you know what's happening to me? Of course, it's a sensitive issue, but it was a major factor in preventing or delaying men disclosing their experience. The sense that this is something that's not talked about, that's not recognised, that no one would understand it, and the sense of shame and the sense of having failed as a man to have this happen to you.
A colleague of mine works with young men in a mental health service, and these are, you know, men high school and just post-high school.
Yep.
She did an informal survey and found that all of her young male clients were experiencing some form of family violence or abuse, but this is often from parents, from siblings, maybe step-parents, other family members. So this is, I guess, broader family violence, not intimate partner violence, though it may have been in some cases from their dating partner. Do you think that more specific research is actually needed into the impacts of other forms of family violence besides domestic violence upon men, especially young men?
Oh, look, particularly upon young men. I mean, a consistent finding across victim surveys and research into violence, this shows that adolescents and young adult men, adolescents and young adults, both male and female, are the major demographic, if you like, for being victims of violence, as well as being the major demographic for being perpetrators of violence.
Mm.
We were disappointed that we had no men under 30 participate in our study, But, I mean, our study was really limited to those men who recognised this experience in themselves and made contact with us, and there's a whole range of reasons why men over 30 might be more likely to do that than men under 30.
It was also limited just to intimate partner violence as well,
yes,
I guess.
Yes, exactly.
Maybe a lot of young men, the violence they experience may be, you know, at the pub or the sporting field or, you know, lots of other different contexts.
Absolutely. But even if you look at the ABS...
The personal safety survey.
Survey. There were higher prevalence rates in both men and women at the younger age groups.
Certainly the recently released Scottish survey found the same. The big question, I guess, one of your recommendations is that community education programs can be designed so as to raise the profile of male victims of intimate partner abuse amongst the general community, but at the same time, and this is really important, not diminishing the profile of female and children victims. How do you think that would best be done? Because I think a lot of people may have genuine concerns that, you know, if we start putting the spotlight onto men, that we may forget about women and children. So how do we do that in a unified way that also teases out the gender differences that are here and not just lumping all victims together as one?
Yeah, look, I don't have an easy answer to that one. I really think that needs a lot of thought, a lot of debate. I think what we're doing, what websites like yours are doing, what some of the media interviews that we've been doing over the last few weeks, a lot of interest in this study and amongst the media in WA and indeed some of the national media as well, I think is important about getting the message out there. I don't have a clear answer to that one, and really we were quite careful in some of our recommendations talking about this is an issue that governments and policy makers need to seriously consider, and we worded it more in that way rather than this should happen, because I don't think we actually really know enough about how to do that.
So in a sense your research is almost starting the conversation, which can then sort of roll on, lead to more research, have a discussion amongst the community, and maybe eventually we will end up with more targeted or detailed solutions, right? Was that a sense in why you left things as more general recommendations?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it would be going too far beyond our data to say, okay, the way this needs to be done, you know, a public campaign needs to say this rather than that, or services need to be designed in exactly this way. I think our data was deliberately exploratory because we didn't want to be limited by making assumptions as to what the issues are. We really wanted to just map out, I suppose, what the issues are in terms of men's experience. And there's a lot of follow-on research and debate that needs to happen as to what does this all mean and what do we do about it. Our recommendation about public awareness campaigns was very much guided by the fact that, and this is my own word rather than, I think a couple of the men did actually use, if not this word, then something similar to it.
Mm-hmm.
But men are isolated in that experience. They don't have a way of understanding and explaining and accepting that, okay, this happens to men, so they think there's something wrong with themselves. And they're very isolated in that experience because they don't expect other people to understand it. So it's something that they can't talk about because they don't know how to articulate it, and they don't expect other people to respond appropriately to it. So they're sort of, well, isolated is the word that I'm using. To put the issue into the public domain lessens that isolation. And it's my view, at least, even though I'm going beyond this data somewhat, that until we do that, I think the sorts of barriers to disclosure that our study identifies will be very difficult to break, even if we train service providers.
Look, it's certainly been one of the... That's probably the strongest theme in the emails and letters of support that we've been receiving since we started the 1 in 3 campaign is that men say, finally, I know I'm not alone, finally there's an organisation that speaks for me and talks about my experience and I can see that other men are going through this, and that overwhelming relief, and that's actually triggered them to write in and tell of their experience. So it's very, I think, cathartic and really releases that sense of isolation for these men. And I couldn't agree with you more in terms of the experience we've had in the 1 in 3 campaign. Look, Dr. Greg Deer, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you today. All the best with your work in the future. And is there any plans for follow-up studies from yourself or your colleagues? Or is...
Well, one of the other co-authors, Emily Tilbrook, who was our research assistant on this project, she did all the interviews. She's doing her PhD in this area, so there'll be sort of some follow-on research that she'll be conducting in that area.
Great.
And both Alfred and I and other researchers as part of our group here in psychology at ECU, certainly looking towards what are the specific projects that we can do next. I mean, ultimately, we would like to do the sort of large-scale prevalence study, and as much as it will be horrendously expensive...
Yes. And take a long time in analysing.
Yeah, I think face-to-face interviews that are constructed so as to engage men in a conversation and then also engage women in the conversation. Now, the way to engage them in the conversation might have to be slightly different, as long as the sort of data that enters into that conversation is comparable, and the way that you code it or quantify it, so that we can have more reliable and more detailed data on the prevalence of men's experience and women's experience, both as perpetrators and as victims. I think it's interesting that I've seen, I think I first saw this about 20 years ago, but that was an isolated observation, but I've seen it quite a bit in the last few years in the mainstream and feminist literature on domestic violence, a real sense of we need to get serious about understanding female perpetrators. And so I think my sense is that there's a whole lot of factors coming together in society and in the research community and in the service community that are probably all coming together at the same time to really move this issue along, rather than have the sort of arguments that people have had in the past, and that somehow identifying men as victims will damage the capacity for people to recognise women as victims.
Moving beyond the politics, which have probably halted the progress of dealing with this issue, you know, over the decades.
I suspect so, and some of that might be reactions to real threats.
Of course.
But my sense is that there is a real maturity in the field that will help us move beyond this and look at family violence in all its forms more comprehensively in a way that will include female-to-male violence as well as all other combinations.
Well, that's a great positive note on which to end our chat today. Dr. Greg Dear, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, and all the best for the future.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it as well.
Don't be so hard on yourself. Those tears are for someone else. I hear your voice on the phone. I hear you feel so alone, my baby. Oh, my baby. Please, my baby. My baby.
Seems so long ago. what's become of them? When you feel like me, I want you to know, don't cry, not alone. Don't cry tonight, my baby. Friends I had before, and I wonder why the ones who care don't call anymore. My feelings hurt, but you know I overcome the pain, and I'm stronger now. There can't be a fire less than the flame. Don't leave me now, 'cause I'm afraid what you've done to me is now the warmth in my bed. Hard enough, they get harder now. Even when we think that we've had enough, don't feel alone. Cause it's all you understand. I'm your sedative. Take a piece of me whenever you can. Don't.
In distress, meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air. Just want to take a few minutes and talk about a story that's been unfolding over the last few weeks. Back in May 20th, Carol Nader published a story which read, "Push to solve custody disputes outside of courts. Separating couples in disputes over children will be able to have a person other than a judge decide who gets custody in a radical change proposed by the federal government to reduce the number of families that end up in court." Now, this whole industry, for want of a better term, is in turmoil. The courts decided to jump in 2006 with the mediation plan. So everyone who wanted to go to the family court needed to go through mediation first. The government set up, I think it was about 63 centres across Australia, family relationship centres, to look after the mediation process.
Which on the face of it seemed like a good idea and a good initiative, because anything to keep people out of the family court is a good idea, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree with you, Ian. Totally agree with you. You know, and the whole thing is to make this process less adversarial and a lot quicker.
And less expensive.
Yeah, that's right. And the whole problem is that... The change which Attorney General Robert McClellan wants to introduce from July next year would mean that separating couples with children will be able to choose arbitration, where a family mediator can decide on custody if attempts at mediation break down, rather than go to the more expensive court process. Now, I deal with lots of family relationship centres, and I've spoken to lots of family dispute resolution counsellors, and I've put this question to them. Would they feel good? Would they feel right in being the arbitrator? And, mate, I haven't had one yes, not one yes. All the family dispute resolution counsellors have said to me, "Phil, I do not want to be part of this."
But isn't that their job anyway? I mean, isn't that what family dispute aren't they doing it anyway?
Well,
what extra are they required to do?
Well, they're not arbitrators as such. They're purely just mediators. So,
okay.
So basically, they are there to facilitate and to steer the conversation between mum and dad to an agreeable outcome. But if that agreeable outcome isn't forthwith after the allocated time, they then get issued what's known as a Certificate 60I, and they forward through to the family court. Now, what the Attorney General is suggesting from July next year is that instead of this Certificate 60I being issued, that the parents have the option for the family dispute resolution practitioner, who has sat with them for probably a total of about 9 hours, to make a decision and say, okay, regardless of where the mediation has fallen down, at this point I'm going to give the decision as to where these children will stay.
Wow, yeah, no, you can understand that. You wouldn't want that responsibility, I guess. I mean,
no, that's right.
You know, really see, and you would really be opening yourself up from a lot of animosity to the partner whose position you went against, you know, in favour of the other one. I mean, I can kind of understand where they're coming from. Well, but then the thing is, if we could get somebody in that position, I mean, anything to keep these matters out of court has got to be a good thing.
It is, absolutely. It would be a great thing, mate. But, you know, the whole situation is that this whole process is in a huge crisis stage. You know, the family courts have waiting times that they cannot sustain. In I think it was October last year, they closed family courts all over Australia and brought all the magistrates into the family court at Parramatta to get rid of a backlog. You know, yep. Right, here we are now in June, so what's that, 8 months later, and we're back in the same situation.
So they're proposing to give the power of the magistrate to the...
to the family dispute counsellor.
The counsellors, yeah.
Yep, and, you know, as I said, I've spoken to various counsellors from various organisations and relationship centres, and not one has said, yep, Phil, that'd be a role I'd like.
Yeah, no, you know? We can kind of understand that. It really would put them in the firing line because judges are sort of isolated. You know, they're up there on the bench and, you know, looking down on the court. But when you're sitting eyeball to eyeball in a situation, there's three of you, or one-on-one for one session, one-on-one for another session, and then maybe get the couple together or the ex-couple You know, you can kind of see that. That's a lot more personal and, you know. But that they would probably be in the best position to...
Well, they certainly have a history of the case, and I guess they have a feel for...
who's talking rubbish, who's the liar.
That's right, where those parents are coming from.
Who's making sense and who isn't.
But at the same time, you know, to have someone who is a trained mediator... and not totally trained in family law, well, you know, that's a scary place to be, and I wouldn't like my children, when they come to have children, to be put in that position where a mediator is making a decision.
Yeah, over their lives. No, I agree with you on there. Anyway, I think that's about it, mate. We've run out of time. That's us for this week. So this show will be available on our website, dadsontheair.net. From either late this afternoon or tomorrow, if you want to hear it again, feel free to download it and have a listen, and we'll be back next week.
Have a good week.
We're dads on the air. We're here 'cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare.